When Deepan Budlakodi speaks about his Canadian immigration case, it's with a kind of jolly, tempered rage. The words tumble out of his mouth.
I remember when I was a child saying, "Oh, Canada," and then out of the blue, a white guard comes up to me and says, "I'm a citizen," and now I'm...
He's so immersed in it, he forgets to start at the beginning.
I'm not
the beginning was so long ago. So much has happened since then.
I have been on my mom's Canadian passport for 4 years, as well as my own Canadian passport for 5 years. And their position is that I'm considered stateless, and they believe that I'm an Indian national.
So let's start at the beginning. Deepan Budlakodi was born in Ottawa on October 17, 1989, to parents from India. For about 4 years, his parents worked for the Indian High Commissioner, India's ambassador to Canada, as domestic help. They cleaned his house, cooked his food, stuff like that. Fast forward to 2009. Deepan's 20. He's had something of a rough childhood.
Well, I got in trouble when I was 19 years old, and I was thrown into Ottawa College and Detention Center.
He landed with a 4-month prison sentence.
And I had an altercation with a guard. I was thrown in the hole, and a guard came up to me and asked me while I was in the hole if I was a citizen and not. And I just want to point out that it's a direct violation of the privacy rights.
Well, information of that nature, I guess,
This is one of his lawyers, Yabar Hamid. He wasn't sure if what the guard did was really illegal, but he agreed that it was unethical.
I wouldn't say that one's nationality is a private concern, but there are several problems with that in terms of, first of all, how that arose as an issue and what role the correctional service officer within a municipal jail was playing within that facility. So it's effectively using agents of the jail as informants for Canada Border Services Agency, and that seems to be improper, because I don't think that security guard or whoever it may be was authorized to ask such a question.
And in any case, the guard asked. That's when Deepan's real problems started. At the time, he gave them his Canadian passport and birth certificate as proof of his citizenship. But someone kept digging and found out about Deepan's parents working for the Indian High Commissioner. That mattered because anyone who works for a diplomat has diplomatic status too. And that matters because children born in Canada to non-citizens with diplomatic status fall into the only exception to the rule that if you're born in Canada, you get Canadian citizenship. It started to seem like, even though Deepan was born in Canada and spent his whole life here, he might not technically be a citizen. Years before, Deepan's parents had applied for permanent residency and then citizenship. And they got it. At one point, they'd also applied for permanent residency for Deepan. But they abandoned the file when someone told them that they didn't need to, that Deepan was automatically a citizen.
They didn't have education. I speak English, so a third party filled it out for them.
This is Deepan during the question and answer session at a panel on his case.
They went to the record clearly stating that they didn't speak English. They did not understand English, so they had a third party fill it out for them. So third party wouldn't fill out the permanent residency application. That document essentially has been thrown out because it doesn't hold any weight anymore. Because the basis of the fact that my parents didn't have knowledge what they're signing because they want to stay in Canada, and they only had a work permit. So you're putting in a situation where you get deported, or you sign a document. What would you do? That's for the permanent. For the citizenship aspect, they weren't going to apply for them themselves because I'm born in Canada. Why would they apply for me?
That's my question, because then it works as reverse logic. When they were applying for citizenship,
during this time, they went to school, they got no one to speak English, and so on and so forth.
So they were more aware in terms of having...
Exactly.
When the Canadian government revoked Deepan's citizenship in 2011, they claimed that his passport had been issued in error, that he had never been a Canadian citizen. Deepan was in prison again at that point, serving a 3-year sentence for a different crime. It looked like he was going to be deported to India as soon as he was released from prison, even though he wasn't an Indian citizen and had never even actually been there. The Ottawa Citizen, a local newspaper, reported in 2012 that Deepan was trying to prepare himself for the life in India he was going to be thrown into when he got out of prison. "I asked if I could get a malaria shot," he told the paper, "but they told me they don't provide that service." But then, two things changed. It turned out that Deepan's parents had stopped work for the Indian High Commissioner several months before he was born. They got a letter as proof. And then, Deepan found out through an access to information request that the Indian government was refusing to accept him on their soil.
I remember when I was a child saying, "Oh, Canada," and then out of the blue, a white guard comes up to me and says, "I'm a citizen, and now I'm stripped of my birthright." How would you feel if your birthright was stripped from you? And now it affects me, it affects my family, and it affects my outcome of my future. India has already clearly stated that I am not an Indian national and will not issue me documents. To this effect, the former High Commissioner has wrote a letter to India, clearly stating my parents that did not work for the High Commission in any capacity as of June 12. I was born in October.
All of a sudden, the Canadian government had reached a wall in Deepan's case. Now, Deepan has launched full throttle into his own campaign, which is called, appropriately, Justice for Deepan. Its website, justicefordeepan.org, is startlingly complete. There's a chronology of his entire life from an immigration standpoint, starting at birth. He has a fundraiser on Indiegogo, a Facebook, a YouTube account, the list goes on. And he's gotten quite a bit of media attention, both from local and national news outlets. But what's even more impressive than Deepan's online persona is his real-life one. Within seconds, literally, of meeting Deepan, I found myself with a Justice for Deepan sticker and business card. "Do you have a Justice for Deepan promotional button?" he asked, handing one over before I could respond. In Montreal, solidarity across borders has taken up his cause. Deepan's case is one of double punishment, a policy of the Canadian government that Solidarity Across Borders advocates against regularly. According to the organization's website, quote, "Double punishment is the term used to describe the unjust policy used against non-citizens who face deportation after being punished for a criminal conviction. In other words, non-citizens who commit criminal offenses are punished twice, once when they're sentenced for their crime, and then again by being permanently removed from Canada, often after living here since childhood."
Well, it's written into the Immigration Refugee Protection Act, which is the statute that governs refugee and immigration policy. So,
this is Jaggi Singh from No One Is Illegal, speaking about double punishment.
Someone can be ruled ineligible if they are found inadmissible to the country, to stay in the country, if they're a non-citizen and if they've been found guilty of a serious crime that can give them 2 years or more in jail. And you don't have to have served time. You don't have to have served any of the time, but you can be ruled inadmissible. It's something that is, we would argue in No One's Legal, something that is racist, because it's highly racialized in terms of who gets criminalized and how people get criminalized. There are certain communities that are disproportionately affected by double punishment, and that happens to completely coincide and completely correlate with those communities that are racially profiled: Caribbean communities, Latino communities, etc.
With Solidarity Across Borders, Deepan went to Justin Trudeau's office in Montreal when he was here on his speaking tour. Although, according to Solidarity Across Borders and Deepan, Trudeau had offered his support in the past, they've been stonewalled recently by email, finally receiving a message that Trudeau wouldn't be able to help out in his case. So they went to Trudeau's office to get a meeting in person, only to be stonewalled there in person.
"I do get your message, and I know, I understand the importance, and I know how it feels like when you're a militant, when you have something that you believe in and you want to push.
Do you know what it feels like?
I'm not saying I don't know your condition. I need some time to think about it, see how I can go around with this, so I'm just going to ask you for now to leave. Give me some time. I'm going to look into it. But as I said, it's not going to be today. I'm just going to ask you for now to leave."
"I mean, frankly, I'm kind of ashamed by your behavior. Anyway, what are you guys here for if you're not here to listen to people?"
"Thank you for exposing your story. From now on, as I said, nothing's going to happen today.
I just want to give you a card, too. Everything's on my website.
Okay.
Everything's on my website, so you can clearly see everything. Your chronology, letters from Amnesty International, letters from unions, letters from CCLA, Canadian Civil Liberties Association, all in support of my case, and have written letters directly to the minister. So please feel free to look at the site and look at the details, and I guess at this point, get back to us in a timely fashion. Can you give us a timeline that you'll get back to us? You're the manager, so you should be clearly easily for you to give us a timeline. And it's based on respect as well.
As I said, I'm going to look into it. I'm going to come back to you on this. But thank you very much for...
I think you owe him at least to give, like, a...
Time frame.
He's just visiting. So this is like...
I have your information. I can contact you with this.
Yes, there's an email account there.
Okay. We'll see from there.
Did you say we were getting back to us? Pardon? Can you give us a commitment to get back to us by the end of the week?
I don't know. So...
After the visit, I spoke to Mary Foster, a Solidarity Across Borders activist. She was the one in the previous clip who said that she was ashamed of Trudeau's office manager's behavior. And afterwards, she was clearly frustrated and livid.
Could you just talk briefly about what... we were just at Justin Trudeau's office. So what just happened?
We just went to... After 4 or 5 months of communicating back and forth by email and phone and receiving a response that Justin Trudeau would not intervene on the file, we decided to go... and try to set up a meeting with Justin Trudeau and deliver a letter. So we went into the office, we delivered the letter, and we asked for some kind of guarantee or commitment that there would be a meeting. And we were told to leave. And the person we spoke to was the office manager, who claimed to have no possibility of contacting anyone without losing his job, which... quite curious, and he absolutely refused to even so much as say that he'd get back to us at the end of the month. So we feel really like the level of accountability to people, obviously shown by that office, is pretty much nil. They just didn't care how they treated us. We felt like we were completely silenced and thrown out without even having the courtesy to promise any kind of follow-up or care in any way practically about the situation.
Something that I thought was really interesting about it is as we were going up in the elevator, there's actually a man who looked like he was probably a security guard who said, like, I don't want any disorder. I hope you're not going to make disorder. And it was kind of this, for me, it was this interesting thing where it's like what this political office is supposed to be about isn't making disorder, isn't kind of like, rabble rousing, quote unquote. It's that everything kind of goes orderly, but the problem is that the order, the way that things function currently, is very obviously against people who don't benefit from the current system.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The fact that we arrived at the door and it was locked. I mean, you can't get into the office to address people who are making decisions for the rest of us without their, first of all, approving us, deciding we're going to be orderly and follow the order. He kept repeating that there's a process for doing things, even though we explained we'd gone through that process for doing things and it hadn't gotten us anywhere, which is why we were trying to disrupt that order and bring a message to people who are taking decisions for us right now. And I think the fact that they're establishing those rules is the first thing we have to get across and the first thing we have to break down and point out that they are actually not responsible to us. They're maintaining an order in order to...
Maintaining neutrality, too.
Maintaining neutrality, so-called neutrality, which is not a neutrality at all, because by failing to speak on Deepan's case, they are allowing and they're participating implicitly in excluding him from society and keeping him in this situation of being denied rights many other people in this country are, and many people are supposed to be entitled to. But this by disrupting that order, I think, is where we can begin to, and calling these people to account and saying, who exactly are you speaking for? Because you're not speaking for us because we're here, as within the order you set up, we're here to say this is what we want you to say. You're ignoring us, so who are you speaking for? So I think disrupting that order is the first way we're going to start making these changes and challenging these calcified privileges that are hiding behind these rules and these orders and these proper procedures for doing things and these, you know, you're being unpeaceful right now. That kind of comment is another way of silencing and preventing people from challenging those privileges.
And Deepan's case is different from the cases of most other people who suffer double punishment because DPEN is currently stateless. That's part of why the Indian government is refusing to accept that Canada deport him there. And so he lives in a legal, bureaucratic limbo, without status in Canada and slapped with all that entails, but without status anywhere else either.
The reality that DPEN's living right now, he's living...
Again, Mary Foster.
In a situation where he doesn't have what Canada offers as privileges. So he doesn't have the ability to cross borders. He doesn't have the ability to access free health care. He doesn't have the ability to get education. He doesn't have the ability to work without the explicit permission and applying for the permission by the state. He doesn't have all of those privileges that people who are accorded Canadian citizenship are given. And there are other people in that situation. I'm not aware of anyone else in Canada at this point, but the classic example is Palestine. In Canada, if you're living as a stateless Palestinian and you don't have another status in Canada, so if you're not a refugee claimant or something, you become deportable, and then Canada can either leave you in a situation where you're under a deportation order to a place that refuses to recognize you.
Because statelessness is essentially an exclusion from the benefits and protection that any state can provide, the UN enacted a resolution in 1975 declaring statelessness undesirable and establishing the signing state's obligation to reduce it whenever possible. Canada ratified the resolution in 1978, 36 years ago. But for now, Dipen Budakodi is still stateless.